So downstairs in my basement, if you go down the stairs and you turn to the left and you wind up back in this little corner between two shelves, you will see a box, and written in marker on the outside of that box is the words Old Tech. And in that box, you're going to find things like this. Some of you recognize this. For those of you guys who are back here in the back row, this is an iPod. Before we had the iPhone, we had the iPod, which would play, you know, hundreds and hundreds of songs. It was cutting edge technology. And so, but inside that box, you'll find other things. I've got a Polaroid camera in there, not one of the new ones, one of the old ones. I've got some video equipment that runs on the old Hi8 stuff with videos of the kids. And I mean, it's just old tech. And the way that box came to be is, it used to be a very small box. Now it's a large box because what happened was something new would come out. And the old was surpassed. And I would take the old, and I didn't want to get rid of it because I just felt like it was still good for something. My fellow pack rats in the room here, you know what I'm talking about? Like, I just feel like I don't want to get rid of it because somebody, somewhere, maybe I could use it again someday. And so the box just gets bigger and bigger, and the tech gets older and older to the place where, like, this stuff is not even supported now. Now, I think when we open up the book of Hebrews, what we find is the author making a similar argument. He's saying to a group of Jewish believers, Hebrew believers, that, hey, that old system did what it was supposed to do. It worked for as long as it should have worked. But now the new has come. And there's no need to go back into the old drawer or the old box and to pull out the old tech. That it's not even supported anymore. It's obsolete. And so the author is making this point, and he does so in what I believe is a genius way. Like you, I've read through the book of Hebrews many, many times. But I'm going to confess to you, when I read it in preparation for you, I think about it at a deeper level. And I've been really wrestling with this text over the past couple of months, trying to figure out, what's he going on about? What is this all about? And where I've come to understand, what I've come to understand is this is a brilliant argument. For the first century audience that listened to him make this argument, they would have walked away with no question but to understand there was nothing left for them in the old system of Judaism. Everything lay in the hands of Christ. And so that's a thing I want you to get today, because I know, like, for most of us, maybe all of us in this room, there's no temptation to go back to the old system of Judaism. Most of us could not even define what that is. And so that's not a temptation for us. But there is a temptation to go back to an old system, to a systems of works where we are trying to earn God's pleasure and work our way to His grace, rather than, as the author would tell us to do, to draw near to Him. Now, in Hebrews chapter 4, we're going to get to Hebrews 7 rapidly, I promise. But in Hebrews chapter 4, you will recall that the author gave us four commands. And these commands were all interlocked and connected. He said in verse number 1 of chapter 4, he said, "Let us fear, lest we find that we haven't really entered into the rest that God has given us." Because when the children of Israel of old did not trust God, they did not fully lean in to the obedience of trusting Him, even though the promised land was given to them, they did not enter the rest. Yet they were freed from Egypt, but they did not enter the promised land. Let us fear, he says. And verse 11, he says, let us strive for this reason. Let us strive to enter that rest. Let us work to make sure that we're there and that our obedience is aligning with what we claim we believe. Because if we claim we believe one thing, but our actions show that we believe something else, or act as though we believe something else, you should trust your actions, because the actions reveal what you really believe inside. And then he says in verse number 14, he says, "For this reason, let us hold fast." This is the answer. The way we strive towards Jesus is we hold fast to the confession of our faith, turning completely to Him. And then finally, He says in verse number 16, let us draw near. And so everything is leading to that place where He says, let us draw near to Him. And what's happening here is the author is leading us to this point where from really 4:16 to the end of the book, the declaration for us, the call for us, is to draw near to Jesus. Can I just pause here for a second and do the preacher thing and tell you, I don't know where you're coming from. I don't know what you face this week. I don't know what you're going to face next week. But I can tell you, whatever it is, you will be able to face it better if you draw near to Jesus. And so whenever the author, in his wisdom, turns to this character called Melchizedek and says, hey, this whole drawing near part has something to do with this character in the Old Testament, I think we should heed his voice. Even though, as we pointed out a couple of weeks ago, even though it's something heavy, like most of us don't walk around saying, you know, I meditated today on Melchizedek. I mean, he's an obscure Old Testament character. But he becomes very, very important. All right, let's get into the text here. Roll with me, back to verse 17 of chapter 6. We're going to read through this together and see what the word of the Lord would say to us this morning. Here we go. So, when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise, that's you and to me and to believing Israel of old, the heirs of the promise, the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath. Now, if you stop and think about that for a moment, you will find that it is really very weird that God would say that he would make an oath for something, which he does. As you remember, the author is appealing back to Psalm 110, verse number 4, where he says, I swear this is going to happen. I'm making this oath, and I'm not going to lie about it. I'm making this oath. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. But here's the weird part. Everything God says is true, right? I mean, every promise he makes is real. Now, for me, if you want to really trust that I'm going to do what I tell you to do, you may make me pinky promise or to swear an oath. But you don't have to do that with God. If God says this is the way it is, there's no oath needed. And yet, in Psalm 110, verse 4, he doesn't just say, hey, this person who's coming, who we know to be the Messiah, is going to be a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. He swears it with an oath. It's almost like God is underlining it, saying, I'm not just serious about this. I am very, very serious. This isn't just a promise. This is a bold for certain, I want everyone to hear it, promise. The author of Hebrews picks up on this in the next verse. Look at what he says. So that by two unchangeable things, one being, of course, the word of God, because every time God says something, it remains true. And the other one being the oath that underscores the word that is true, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled for refuge might have strong encouragement to do what? Now there it is again. To hold fast to the confession of our faith, to the hope that is set before us. Now look at verse number 19. We have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of our soul, of hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain where Jesus has gone as the forerunner on our behalf, having become, and here it is, a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Now, the problem with that particular phrase for you and I is that we don't fully appreciate the scandalous statement that he has just made. We have spent so long as Christians thinking about Jesus as our high priest that we just take it for granted. But this is one of the earliest declarations of this very obvious fact to us, that he was a high priest. And so whenever the author says this, perhaps the ears of those who were listening would have perked up, because they know something to be true. Jesus, as the author is going to point out here in just a few minutes, was a descendant of the tribe of Judah. All of the priests were descendants of the tribe of Levi, and specifically out of the house of Aaron. And so Jesus is a whole different thing. He can't be the high priest because he wasn't descended from Levi and through the family tree of Aaron. And so what the author does here is he points out that Jesus isn't simply a high priest. He is a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Not Levi, but of this obscure character out of Genesis. Not Levi, who we are introduced to in the book of Exodus and Numbers, but out of this priest of Salem, this king of Salem, who we're introduced to in Genesis. Now, before we go any further, let me just give you a little bit of foreshadowing of what we're about to see. The author of Hebrews is going to prove that Jesus is the better priest, and that all of that old stuff, like the old tech that you have that we kind of hang on to that's obsolete, we just need to lay that aside and cling only to the new, the fresh work of Jesus Christ. And he's going to do that by making three points. And in chapter 7, he lays it out for us. And like if you read chapter 7, it gets very wordy. But we're going to see that essentially he's making three arguments. Here they are. I'm going to give them to you quick, and then we're going to look at them together. Number one, the order of Melchizedek is better because Melchizedek is superior to Abraham, which is huge. Like for us, we're like, oh, big deal. But for them, whenever you say, as the author is about to say, that Melchizedek is an individual who is more significant than Abraham, it's enormous because Abraham was the patriarch. He was the founder of the nation. And so that's huge for them. And so, number one, Melchizedek is superior to Abraham. His priesthood accomplishes what the priesthood of Levi could not accomplish. And finally, his priesthood is eternal, where the priesthood of Levi is not. And so the author is going to use these three points to say, let all that old stuff go. You want to know what happens to the old tech? You want to know what happens to the old stuff now that Jesus has become the priest after the order of Melchizedek? You set it aside, and here's why. Number one, we're told that Melchizedek is greater than Abraham. Now, the reason he's making this point is because Abraham, as we just said, is the forerunner. He is the founder of the Jewish nation. And so if he can prove that Melchizedek is greater than Abraham, and Abraham is greater than Levi, then it stands to reason that Melchizedek, this order, this new priesthood, is greater than all of it. I hope you're with me. You understand what's happening here, that Levi is a descendant of Abraham, and he is the father of the tribe that became the priestly group that the people would go and make sacrifices to. And so the author is going to make two points here. First off, he's going to say that Melchizedek is greater than Abraham because of what Abraham gives to Melchizedek. Namely, he gives him a tithe. Look at verse number 4, chapter 7. See how great this man was to whom Abraham partitioned. He gave a tenth of the spoils of this war. Okay, I know what you're thinking. What's going on here? All right, very quickly. You remember a couple of months ago, we went through the life of Lot, Abraham's nephew. Lot had gotten himself into trouble, had gotten himself captured. Abraham gathered together some men of war, went and fought against the kings of the north and defeated them. And on the way back down to Salem, to Sodom, to return Lot and all of his servants and everyone back to their home territory, he crosses this individual named Melchizedek. And there, Melchizedek blesses him, and Abraham gives to him a tenth, a tithe. Now, of course, you know, because you are excellent biblical students, that the tithe was not officially instituted until Exodus, until the law. But yet here is Abraham giving a tenth to Melchizedek, this priest who only appears in Genesis and then vanishes. And the author says, think about it this way. Levi would collect tithes from his brothers. But Abraham, Levi's great-grandfather, paid tithes to Melchizedek. And so in a very real way, it's almost like Levi was paying tithes to Melchizedek. Now, I know that may seem kind of weird for you and I, but essentially what he's saying is if Abraham is greater than Levi, and Levi collected tithes from his brothers, and yet Abraham gave tithes to Melchizedek, in some way, Abraham must be lower than, he must be subordinate to Melchizedek. Isn't that very exciting? It's far more exciting than I'm making it, all right? So keep in mind, head cold, all of that stuff. Anyways, so we see his superiority, number one, because of what Abraham gives to Melchizedek, but number two, because of what Melchizedek gives back to Abraham. Melchizedek, as Abraham comes back through and stops by Salem, which we know to be Jerusalem, Melchizedek's name is Mel is the word for king, Melech. Melchizedek is the word for righteousness, so he's the king of righteousness, and he's in Salem. He is in the place of peace, shalom, the place of shalom. So he is both the king of righteousness and the king of peace. The author points out when he comes through, the author tells us that he blesses Abraham. Now, let me just ask you for a second. If someone blesses you, like if they come in and they give you something that you don't have, doesn't that tell you that they are in some way better than you? They have more than you have. They have something that you don't possess. Well, that's exactly what's happening here. The author of Hebrews picks up on this and says, concerning the blessing that Melchizedek gave to Abraham, he says, it is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. See, we may announce, bless the name of the Lord, but we're not actually blessing him. We're not bringing him something he doesn't already have. He blesses us. Why? Because he's superior. And so the author takes these four verses out of Genesis 14, and he exegetes them to say, Abraham was a great guy, but Melchizedek was greater. See, the assumption is for you and I today that whenever God called Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldees, that Abraham was like the only guy God was working with. But whenever you look back into the Old Testament and you see Job, and you see Jethro, Abraham's or Moses' grandfather, and you see Melchizedek, you find out that God has had worshipers all over the world since the very beginning. And here is this priest, the priest of Salem, whom Abraham shows up and he gives him a tithe. Now later, King David is going to see this story. And he is going to create this psalm where he says concerning Melchizedek that this is a different priesthood. This isn't about Levi. This is about a greater priesthood because it came before Levi. And David is going to say that you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. In other words, what he's saying is that, hey, this priesthood that Abraham is working with here, when he's giving tithes to, is totally separate from Levi and therefore lasting. All right, number two. So first we see that Melchizedek, the order of the priesthood of Melchizedek was greater than the order of Levi, the old priesthood, because Abraham paid tithes to him. And Melchizedek blessed him. Melchizedek is greater than Abraham. All right, I promise this next part's going to be more interesting. Here we go. Number two, his priesthood, Melchizedek's priesthood, is more effective than Levi's priesthood. Now, what the author does here is he proves that what the priest could not do through Levi, Jesus did. See, look at the next verse here, verse number 20. He says, "Now, if perfection had been attained through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need would there have been for there to be another priesthood to arise after the order of Melchizedek?" What's he saying here? He's saying if the priesthood of Aaron was able to make perfect anybody, then why would God ever establish a new priesthood? If that old system worked, there would be no need for a new system. We might would say it this way today. If it ain't broke, why fix it? That's what the author is saying here. Secondly, he continues and he says, because that's what reveals to us the old priesthood could not do, but what the old priesthood could not do, the priesthood of Jesus did do. Listen to verse number 18 and 19. "For on the one hand, a former commandment is set aside because of its weakness and uselessness." We do not appreciate how radical that statement is. He basically has just said concerning all of the law, and it's pointing to the worship and the sacrificial system and all of that stuff that you've been doing and your forefathers have been doing, even though it's significant, it's weak and it's useless. Why? Because it wasn't able to make anyone perfect. And so there was a new priesthood that was established, one that was able to make perfect where this priesthood could not. And anytime the author says that you change the priesthood, you inevitably must change the laws. Because the new priesthood is going to have its own laws and its own standards. Jesus came and established a new priesthood. His laws, his standards, are a fulfillment of the law. But they do for us what the law could not do. If you've not heard anything else, hear this. The priesthood of Jesus accomplishes through his work what we could not accomplish through our own. This is what he says. "But on the other hand, a better hope." How many of y'all believe Jesus is a better hope? Better than anything, right? "Better hope is introduced through which we draw near." There it is again. Can you see it? Those four "let us" commands from chapter 4 that end with "let us draw near." Here it is again. Let us draw near. Why? Because Jesus' priesthood is more effective. All right, number three. So we see how the author points out that Melchizedek, whatever all of this is, Melchizedek is greater than Abraham, and so therefore he's greater than Levi, which means his priesthood is greater than the priesthood of Levi. Number two, his priesthood is greater because his priesthood was able to accomplish what the priesthood of the Levites were not able to accomplish. You are a priest for how long? Forever. Forever. Number three, the priesthood of Melchizedek is greater, not just because of those two reasons, but finally because that priesthood is eternal. There were probably somewhere around 100 priests, high priests, in Israel from the Old Testament to the New Testament. Maybe more, a couple hundred, depending on how you divide it up. But there were thousands of priests. Thousands and thousands of priests. Do you know why there were thousands and thousands of priests? Because they died. And whenever a priest would grow old and he would pass away, someone would have to come and fill his shoes. But not so with Jesus. This Jesus, well, he was totally different. His priesthood is eternal. Okay, how is his priesthood eternal? Well, the author points out two ways. First off, we can see that it's eternal because of the way that he entered into the priesthood. Most priests, whenever they were appointed into the priesthood, became priests because their fathers were priests. And so they were born into it. Look at what he points out here. He says, the order of Melchizedek, the priest that came after Melchizedek, wasn't born into the priesthood. He was made a priest by the oath of God. Significant. He didn't get drafted into it. How many of you all have ever seen someone who, like, their father or their grandfather created an incredible business, and the descendant, the son, the grandson, took over the company and drove it straight into the ground? And he was there, and he had the job just by virtue of his parentage. It's not the best way to select a qualified individual. The best way to select a qualified individual is to look all over earth and to find the best individual for the job. Or if you're God, to look all over the universe and to find the most qualified individual for the job. If God turns his gaze all over the universe, looking for the most qualified individual to be priest for that job, do you know who he finds? He finds Jesus. He enters into the priesthood not because he was born into it, but because with an oath God has declared it to be so. The author of Hebrews says it was not without an oath, for those who formerly became priests were made such without an oath. They were just born. They were set apart, they were sanctified, but there was no oath from God for it. But this one was made a priest with an oath by the one who said of him, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." So that's the way that he enters into the priesthood, but finally, the way that he continues into the priesthood. The author concludes his argument by saying this: the former priests were many in number. We already discussed why they were many in number, because they died. They were mortal because they were prevented by death from continuing in that office. But he holds this office permanently because he continues how long? Forever. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And watch what he does here next. In this great promise, he tells us that this, because of these truths, that Jesus is the greatest high priest that God ever could have sent for us. For this reason, this makes Jesus the guarantor of a better covenant. There is no better system than the one that God has selected through Jesus Christ. Listen, please hear me. We cannot, when we get to heaven, there will not be a single voice in heaven or hell that will say, God did not give his best to redeem fallen humanity. He established this priesthood under the fallen Levitical tribe because they were fallen. And it looked forward to this greater opportunity in Jesus Christ. But at the end of the day, all that the law could do was to reveal to us that we were sinners and could not become unsinners. We needed something far greater. Listen to this. We're almost done. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who do what? To draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercessions for them. Don't just gloss over that phrase. Let's look at it one more time. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost. No matter what the distance is, or how far you've gone, or how much you've been broken, or how terrible you've been, or how wayward you've gone, or what kind of terrible, prodigal son you are, he is able to save to that distance. His arm is not too short that it cannot save. He's able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives. Where every other priest has died, he lives forever. He always lives to make intercession for them. For it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest. It just makes sense, the author says. This is exactly what you would expect from a loving, gracious God, to give us such a high priest, holy and innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He has no need like those old priests, the old tech, the stuff that has served its purpose but now has been made obsolete, who had to offer sacrifices daily first for his own sins and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints, the author tells us, men in their weakness. That's me, right? That's you. We are appointed in our weakness to demonstrate our dependence on a God who gets all the glory for anything good that we do. So God appoints them in their weakness as high priest, but the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son who has been made perfect, the author tells us. How long? Now again, I know what you're thinking to yourself. Well, Pastor, great. But this isn't like my struggle. I mean, I don't have a temptation to go look for the synagogue and to go in to worship as though I'm a Hebrew. I'm not looking to make a sacrifice. And even though that may not be your specific temptation, I think the author of Hebrews would teach us today, his teachings would reveal to us the fact that you and I do have temptations to water down the excellence of the priesthood of Jesus Christ. Jesus is the greatest mediator between God and man, period. Because he's God himself. This is why, ladies and gentlemen, I am a firm believer in the First Amendment as it is written. I believe in the free exercise of religion. I don't believe in the teachings of Confucius or the Dalai Lama or Muhammad or Joseph Smith. I don't follow the teachings of the popes. I follow the teachings of Scripture. But I would go to the mat for any of those people to be able to stand up on the street corner and to say, this is what we believe. Why is that? Whenever I believe this to be true, yet I look at the First Amendment and I think to myself, I am perfectly fine with everyone else bringing their best to the conversation. Do you know why? Because I don't think Jesus is afraid of Muhammad. I don't think Jesus is afraid of the real Jesus, is afraid of Joseph Smith. I don't think the real Jesus is afraid of Confucius or the Dalai Lama or popes or priests or preachers. No, he is the greatest with all clarity. What do you add to this? Show me any other faith that reveals that God himself as a son came down and acted as the mediator between God and man. And that it was so precisely planned that in the book of Genesis, all the way back to the very beginning of the Bible, there is this obscure little story that for hundreds and hundreds of years after it was written, went unannounced, unaddressed, until David picked up a pen and said, "This is it. This is the priesthood that the Messiah is coming from. This is what it's going to look like when the Messiah comes. He's going to be a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And his priesthood is going to be far better than that which is currently observed at the tabernacle or the temple. Jesus is the greatest mediator of all." That means that you and I, as followers of Christ, we do not need to back down when we stand up in the public forums and we announce that we are followers of Jesus. We should do so with great love, but with tremendous confidence, because there is no better high priest than this. And so we can say with certainty that no other faith makes a claim anywhere near as bold as this. And no other faith has demonstrated the reality of that promise, of that claim. No other faith has demonstrated the reality of that claim the way that our God has done through the resurrection. He lives forever. This also tells me, as we pointed out before, that this voice inside of my head that constantly pushes me to be more deserving of God's grace and His mercy, even though I say I know it's Jesus alone that saves me, this little temptation within me that causes me to think, but I know I still need to do my little part. I need to add something to my, I need to bring my own little sacrifice. I need to bring my own little service at works-based religion. This passage tells me that all of that is a waste because Jesus has made the sacrifice. As the author is going to be pointing out here in the next few chapters, he wasn't just the priest making the sacrifice. He was the sacrifice himself. And that sacrifice having been made, he has set down at the right hand of the Father. If you have come to a place where you hold fast the confession of faith in Jesus Christ, your salvation has been paid for. The old temptation to do something different, to go to some other religious practice or some other god, is like the old tech. It's a waste of time. Jesus is the greatest mediator between God and man.